Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name's Clayton Boyce, and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor of the Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and the guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Friday, October 15th, Gordon Binder, president and CEO of Amgen, a biotechnology company, will present a speech entitled, Will the Biotechnology Industry Survive Healthcare Reform? On Monday, October 18th, the Prime Minister of Turkey, Tansu Çiller, will speak on U.S.-Turkish relations. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include author Stephen King, a debate between DNC Chairman David Wilhelm and RNC Chairman Haley Barbour, the former coordinator of the European Economic Community's African Elephant Project, Ian Douglas Hamilton, and former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me. I'll ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right, Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. John Chase of the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel. Bruce Alpert of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Andrea McCarron, WUSA-TV, here in Washington. Stephen Ogg, business editor, ABC News. Andrew Glass, Washington bureau chief of Cox Newspapers. Tom Williamson, solicitor of labor. Christy Wise, a freelance writer and vice chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Tom Glynn, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Labor. Susan King of WJLA-TV. Hirotsuko Koike, Washington Bureau Chief of Nikkei. Howard Banks of Forbes Magazine. Steve Greenhouse, The New York Times, and Kevin Selwyn of The Wall Street Journal. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, and Melanie Abdo-Dermott for organizing today's luncheon. Robert Reich has credentials, like degrees from Dartmouth and Yale. He is a Rhodes Scholar, a Harvard lecturer, currently a member of the Clinton cabinet, the Secretary of Labor. But in a recent profile of the secretary, a reporter used one word to describe Robert Reich, thinker. He has been lecturing, writing, and promoting ideas about nearly everything. As Labor Secretary, Mr. Reich has had 9 months to let his ideas germinate. Today he brings us the story of how Washington reality meets the ivory tower ideal. Washington is certainly not a new town for Mr. Reich. He's been in and out of this capital over the years. The Department of Labor has often been considered real estate outside the power game, but Mr. Reich has a special position by dint of his longtime friendship with the president. The two met on the boat en route to their Rhodes Scholarship years at Oxford. When Mr. Reich was nominated by the president for the job, Mr. Clinton said Mr. Reich was one of the most trusted advisors and closest friends he had. In this town, that phrase can be taken to the bank, at least in most places. The first few days at his new job, Secretary Reich, who closed the Labor Department's fancy dining room, was determined to show his proletarian roots. He joined other executives in the cafeteria so they could meet, quote, the real workers. On the lunch line, Mr. Reich was chatting with one woman who began our conversation with the traditional Washington line, where do you work? Upstairs, I'm the secretary, Mr. Reich said simply. The woman responded, "Who's secretary?" Those in Congress haven't been asking which secretary he works for. He's been testifying on summer youth jobs, one-stop shopping, job training, school-to-work apprenticeships, and the Commission on Labor Management Cooperation. But Secretary Reich doesn't head for Capitol Hill to sit at the traditional long rectangular table before a cluster of congressmen and women and a bank of lights and microphones. For the House Committee on Education and Labor, Secretary Reich donned a microphone, took out a series of colored charts, and propped them up on an easel, and for 15 minutes, without notes, lectured the congressman on worker injury rates. The congressmen were spellbound. One Republican remarked, "In my 13 years in Congress, your performance today is truly the most impressive by a cabinet secretary." Robert Reich can boast one historical note in his first year as secretary. He is the first cabinet secretary since the Harding administration to sport a beard. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the National Press Club, Labor Secretary Robert Reich.
Well, thank you very much, Clayton. I promised Clayton that we would have time for questions and maybe a few answers. I promised him to be short. An unnecessary request, as a matter of fact. Let me just introduce, actually, there is a, like politicians, I have a platform to stand on. Here. Before I begin, let me introduce a couple of my colleagues who I see are here. You've already been introduced to two of them. Alina Berg. Alina, if you could stand up. Alina is Assistant Secretary for Pension and Benefit Administration and will have a lot of responsibility with regard to the new health care reform. Mary Maher. Mary, are you here someplace? Press Secretary, waving in the background, clutching my remarks today. She will give them out for a small fee, I understand. There is also Tom Williamson, you've already met. Tom, Solicitor of Labor. Tom is a genuine certified FOB. And Tom and the President and I all met on the boat on that historic voyage. And also Tom Glynn, you have been introduced to. Tom is the Deputy Secretary of Labor and comes with a distinguished background with regard to making things happen. Tom, you remember the Kingston Trio? Will they ever return? Tom ran the MBTA in Boston, and I don't know how many people you did lose, Tom, in that. But not too many, Tom says. And let me just say a few things. I have spent a number of years in academe. I can tell you after almost 9 months here in Washington, there is a difference between politics in the Capitol and politics in academe. Real politics here in Washington, it's dog eat dog. In academe, it's precisely the reverse. Think about it. But I was in Washington through most of the 1970s, both in the Ford administration and in the Carter administration. Clayton, I noticed you did not point out that my first job, my very first job in Washington, was working for Robert Bork. What I wanted to talk about today was the jobs issue. And I want to talk about it in a slightly different way from perhaps the way in which it has been talked about. Because when we talk about jobs in this country, generally speaking, we are talking about the number of jobs or the unemployment rate. And although the unemployment rate is still too high, most recently 6.7%, the trend is in a good direction. Over the last 8 months, over 1 million new jobs in the United States, which is more than all of the jobs created in the previous 4 years. Now, California is still in the doldrums. California is still a major, major jobs issue and a major jobs problem. Inner city youth, particularly, a major jobs issue, continues to be a major jobs problem. But in terms of numbers of jobs, they are beginning to come back. And that's good news. It should make us feel very confident. If fourth quarter annualized growth is in the range of over 3%, as I believe it will be, and if growth next year is in the range of 3%, as I believe it will be, we will see that unemployment rate continue to drop. That's also good, and that is also comforting. So why are people worried? I've spent a lot of the time over the last 8.5 months, I've been Secretary of Labor, out in the world, out in America, Cleveland, and Florida, and New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Pennsylvania, Vermont, California. I've talked to a lot of people around the country, workers in Kansas. What I pick up is anxiety, deep anxiety. And there's a little bit of a paradox here because the jobs are beginning to come back, and yet people keep on asking me, where are the jobs? What jobs? I talk about job training, and they say, training for what? Where are the jobs? Where are the jobs? The jobs anxiety out there is coloring, it is affecting, it is the background for a lot of the initiatives of the Clinton administration right now. Military conversion made more difficult because of all of that jobs anxiety. The North American Free Trade Act made more difficult because of that jobs anxiety. Even health care made more difficult because of that general sense among the public that maybe we don't want to change. Even though change is necessary, we're worried, we're concerned. Again, let me restate the paradox. Jobs are coming back. Unemployment is dropping. We've created 1 million new jobs, over 1 million new jobs in the past 8 months, and yet people are still worried. Why are they worried? What is all this anxiety about? I believe the anxiety has two causes, fundamentally. It has less to do with the number of jobs we're creating, because as I said, although we could do much better, and we will do better, and we should do better, we're on the right track in terms of number of jobs. The sources of the anxiety are twofold, and they are different from the number of jobs. Source of anxiety number one is the quality of the jobs. There is an increasing gap between the jobs occupied by college graduates, the 25% of our people who have graduated from four-year colleges, and everybody else. For the past 15 years, most Americans have been on a downward trajectory with regard to their incomes adjusted for inflation. And that downward trajectory for most Americans continues even though they are getting jobs. Many of the new jobs are not very good jobs. They don't pay very well. Many of them are temporary jobs and part-time jobs. Many of them are insecure jobs. Americans are concerned because they see that downward trajectory and they don't see an end to it. Not so much the number of jobs, but the quality of the jobs. There is more inequality today, that is between the highest paid, mostly college educated, and the lowest paid, than at any time since we began keeping data on relative equality of wages back in 1967. In fact, there's much cause to believe that there's more inequality today than at any time since the end of the Second World War. 18% of full-time workers are not earning enough to keep a family of four out of poverty. We are seeing a rise in the number of working poor in this country. It is a major, major problem for this nation. I said that there were two causes of anxiety, the gap between the well-educated and everyone else is growing, and most other people are on a downward trajectory. That's problem number one. Problem number two has to do with the fact that if you do have a job now, you were probably less secure in your job than Americans were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, at any time since the Second World War. Let me ask you for a show of hands. How many of you feel secure in your present job? Put up your hands. You're lying. There is not very much job security today, even among chief executive officers. And what we are finding is that if you are laid off from your job, the duration of unemployment is much longer than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. You know, in the 1970s, about 11% of those who were unemployed for 6 months or more. And remember, 6 months is the duration of unemployment insurance. In the 1980s, it went up to 15 or 16%. 15 or 16% of the unemployed were long-term unemployed, beyond 6 months. We are now up to 20% of the unemployed are long-term unemployed. It used to be that if you did your job conscientiously, so long as your company survived, you'd continue to have your job. If there was a recession, you were laid off, perhaps, but you would get the job back at the end of the recession. We had the term laid off, implying that you would be back on the payrolls when the recession ended. No longer. These days, you may lose your job even from a healthy company. American companies in September were laying workers off at the rate of over 2,000 a day. And chances are you're not going to be getting your old job back again. Relatively fewer workers, far fewer workers, are getting their old jobs back again. Most people have to find new jobs. Again, let me stress these two sources of job insecurity. One, the downward trend in earnings and income for most American workers, the increasing gap between the well-prepared, the college-educated, and everyone else. And secondly, the insecurity on any job, the increasing duration of unemployment. I said at the outset that I believe that these two factors, more than even the number of jobs, are affecting the way Americans regard innovations and changes. We've always in this country, we've been able to embrace innovation and change. We believed in progress. Progress was a hallmark of the American spirit. Change, whether it was immigrants or international trade and investment, new inventions, technologies, moving from place to place, Americans have always been the people who understood and embraced change more than any other people on this planet. Many of us had to embrace change even for our ancestors to get here. But what's going on now? As we see those two sources of job anxiety continue and increase, there may be less faith in progress, less faith in the future, more desire to hold on to what we have. The North American Free Trade Act is, in my view, good for this country. I can say that as Secretary of Labor unambiguously. It will create more jobs. It will create better jobs. You have only to think about it for a moment. Their tariffs on goods coming from the United States to Mexico are 2.5 times on average our tariffs on goods coming from Mexico to the United States. And yet we still are selling them more than they are selling to us by a whopping over $5 billion surplus. Why? Because their market is growing so fast. Third world nations, developing nations in Latin America and in Asia are the fastest growing markets in the world. We shouldn't be embracing those markets. What opportunities? In the post-Second World War era, America developed all kinds of trading relationships with countries whose populations were much, much poorer than ours. We led the way internationally to free trade. So what's going on right now? Why has NAFTA become a symbol a lightning rod for anxieties. Or to take a second example, for years and years, Americans couldn't wait for the day. We hoped and hoped and hoped for the day when we would not have to maintain a huge military presence, when the Cold War would be over, when we could make products which help people and clothe people and house people and help transport people rather than products which maimed and killed people. And yet, the struggle to downsize defense has become enormously problematic, contentious, difficult, not only in California, but around the country. Why? Why, when we need to do that, when it's so obvious we need to do that, why so contentious? When it's so obvious that we, in this country, are going to be dependent much more for our national security in the future on a well-trained, well-educated workforce than on our armaments? Why, when it's so obvious that we need not so much foreign intelligence, but greater intelligence of Americans, American workers, American young people. Why is it so difficult? Again, the answer, I believe, the two sources of job anxiety, which I pointed to. And finally, the healthcare sector. There is no one who understands this better than the president. He has made the case as forcefully as it can be made. American companies understand the critical importance for competitiveness of getting some control over those soaring healthcare costs, which are now almost completely out of control, rising twice the rate of inflation, imposing a huge burden, over $200 billion burden on American companies. A contentious issue, the most contentious issue these days between labor and management, forcing many Americans to stay put in jobs for which they're overqualified for fear of losing their health insurance. We have got to do something. We have got to do something that is bold. We understand that. And yet, even now, just as we embark upon this great debate, we hear voices saying, temper our enthusiasm. Why? Again, I believe because of anxiety over jobs. What is the effect on jobs? The Clinton administration is tackling these underlying anxieties. There is no magic cure. There is no instant elixir. There is no obvious way of overcoming these two great sources of job anxieties. But I want to just suggest to you what we are doing and how we are doing it. First, with regard to the increasing decline of Americans without college educations. Why, by the way, is it happening? It's happening for the same reason that Americans with four-year college degrees are doing relatively well, because technology is demanding and rewarding people who can solve and identify problems. Less and less are people being rewarded for their muscle or their stamina. More and more, they're being rewarded for their ability to solve and identify problems. It's happening in every country. It's a shift in fundamental in the demand function for labor. If you are not able to solve and identify problems, you are worth less and less. And so one place to begin, one place we are beginning, has to do with education and training and career routes for very many young people. The Goals 2000 Educational Standards Initiative, now on the Hill, hopefully voted on within the next 2 weeks, is a piece of the puzzle. Now, the federal government's leverage with regard to local education is, of course, limited, but we can at least set standards. Secretary of Education Riley and I have been marching around town, marching around the nation. I was going to say shoulder to shoulder, but I should say shoulder to hip. And we have been making the case, the importance for a workforce of the future of these high educational standards. One provision sets skill standards for young people who may not be able to go to college, maybe not be able to go to college immediately. Skill standards that enable young people to move from school to work the last 2 years of high school, the first year or so afterwards, getting a skill, a real-world skill, mixing work-based learning with school-based learning, and at the end have a skill that is portable, that employers can recognize as a building block skill on which employers can further invest. It is ludicrous that in this country that four-year college degree has got to be the parchment that separates out the winners from the losers. No other industrialized country makes that demand. We have the best system of higher education in the world, but one of the worst systems in any other industrialized country for getting kids from school to work who are not going on to a four-year university. It's time we change that. And we are intending to change it. The School to Work Opportunities Act, already introduced into Congress, is going to be one of the key building blocks of a very different kind of system. Direct student loans for young people who may not otherwise be able to afford college, another of those key building blocks. And let me also bring your attention to one of the least talked about but most important initiatives already created by the Clinton administration, and that is the Earned Income Tax Credit, enabling the working poor to do better. The working poor getting an income supplement which raises their income floors. A terribly important, the most important poverty program we have, based on work, not on welfare. We've done it already. We have it in place. There is much left to be done about the increasing gap between the well-educated and not so well-educated, but these elements of the puzzle are at least taking shape. We are working on them, and Congress is working on them, and there's bipartisan support for them if they are not already enacted. Now, what about the second problem I've mentioned, that insecurity, that increasing duration of unemployment? I don't know how many of you follow the numbers, the budget numbers, the federal expenditure numbers. But over the last 2 years, beginning in November of 1991, when the federal government first extended regular unemployment insurance, given all of the people who were using up their regular unemployment insurance because of the duration of unemployment, since November of 1991, the federal government has spent $25 billion on extended unemployment insurance. This is beyond the normal federal state unemployment insurance system. This is for people beyond the normal 26 weeks, $25 billion over the last 2 years. Can we go on doing this forever? Probably not. What do we do, though, with all of the people I mentioned before, more and more Americans who are using up their extended benefits? Beginning this week, by the way, because Congress has not yet acted on the administration's request for extending benefits again, beginning this week, I have had to instruct states to stop taking applications for extended benefits. That means that this week, 50,000 Americans, an estimated 50,000 Americans, are going to use up their unemployment insurance benefits and have nothing else to fall back on, until or unless Congress acts. Now, notwithstanding the urgency of extended benefits, that obviously cannot be the answer. The answer, it seems to me, lies in moving from an unemployment insurance system designed to tide people over during the down troughs of the business cycle until they got their old job back again, to a re-employment insurance system, a system that is geared to helping people move quickly, rapidly into new jobs. And we are working on that at this moment. It's a high priority of the president. It's a high priority of this administration. We are, and we have evidence, that if you get to a worker who loses his or her job early, and you give that worker job counseling, job search assistance, information about where the jobs are, and where appropriate training, long-term training, training that may extend beyond 26 weeks, you have a much higher chance, much better chance, of getting that worker placed in not only a job, but a good job. You reduce the duration of unemployment. We know, we've done experiments. We need to make it easy for Americans to move from job to job. There is nothing disgraceful or abnormal about losing a job. It is now the normal part of a career. It is not because you did something wrong. It's not because you failed to fulfill your obligations and duties or act conscientiously. It is part of the way our economy now works. And we must make it easy for people, one-stop shopping, easy for people to get not only income support, but also job counseling, job search assistance, and everything else they need to move quickly and expeditiously to the next job. There are other things we can do. Health insurance also reduces job anxiety because so many people now are worried about losing their job because they're worried about losing their health insurance. If we have a system of health insurance there, there is less job anxiety simply because you don't have to worry about health insurance for yourself and your family. Pensions. We want to make that more secure. 2 weeks ago, I announced the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation's new initiative for fully funding underfunded pension plans. Again, so that American workers have more security. In sum, I want to emphasize this tricky word, security. It is a tricky word, because to some people, security sounds like holding on to the past. Inflexibility. That is not how we are using the term. In any democratic society, in any free society, people who are worried and anxious will choose one of two means of improving their security. They will either try to hold on to the past, or they will adapt measures, such as the measures I've talked about, which eases the transition to the future. Those are the only practical alternatives in a free society. Either holding on to the past, or seeking to, or easing the transition to the future. If we do not have in place a system for easing the transition of Americans to the future, Americans almost automatically, understandably, are going to opt to hold on to the past. Where is all that opposition coming from to NAFTA? Where is all that opposition coming from to defense bill downs, the worry about so many initiatives? Where in the world is an initiative coming from that suggests, as I heard the governor of California suggest not too long ago, that the children of illegal immigrants should be denied public education? What are we saying to each other in this country? Insecurity will come out in very negative ways if we don't provide positive security that eases the adjustment of Americans to a new economy. And that, my friends, is the Clinton jobs agenda. Thank you. And now let me take your questions. I don't know how you normally...
Right behind you.
Oh, you have questions already. Clayton has questions. I don't know how you got the questions so quickly. How do we do...
I'll ask them and you...
I take the card like Karnak the Magnificent.
Right.
And I hold it up to my... Okay. Yes.
I have to say you're a terrific public speaker because your prepared text is still sitting up here with not one page turned. Meanwhile, I have to have my name in writing or I won't remember it. The first question is about NAFTA. It's actually three questions. How much will worker retraining for NAFTA cost? Are existing retraining programs effective? And for what jobs would displaced workers be retrained?
Okay, let me take each of those questions in order. Number one, how much will worker retraining for workers displaced by NAFTA cost? Our intention is to create a temporary displaced worker program for NAFTA, again, on the notion that we want to aim for a more comprehensive program. Rather than having, as we do now, a lot of very specific categorical programs for particular groups of workers displaced for particular reasons, almost as if they are exceptions to the general rule, The administration wants, as I suggested, to have a comprehensive program to help any worker, regardless of cause, and that's what we're aiming toward. In the meantime, there's got to be a bridge to help any Americans who might be displaced by the North American Free Trade Act. Our estimation, by the way, is a very small amount of displacement. Our net effect is going to be positive with regard to jobs. We are, again, this is subject to discussion, but our tentative goal is to have a workforce adjustment piece of NAFTA that is approximately $100 million in size. Second related part of the question, are existing retraining programs effective? The answer is long-term training, that is training usually for a year or more, has been shown to be very effective. In fact, most studies show that the return on long-term training for each year is about 5% return with regard to future income. That's why college-educated Americans are doing very, very well relative to non-college educated. That's why people who have a year or two of community college or technical institute instruction are doing fairly well. They're kind of between the high school educated and the college educated. We have to make sure that more Americans have the opportunity for long-term training. Short-term training is a mixed bag. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. The most difficult group for with regard to short-term training, in which the evidence suggests that it doesn't work at all, are disadvantaged young males. Other groups, it depends on how you train and what you are training for. Third question, for what jobs would displaced workers be retrained? Be specific, says the question. Well, as I've gone around the country, I have been examining what it is that particularly non-college-educated workers, non-four-year college-educated workers, are doing. And again, not so much what they're doing or the jobs that are increasing, because there are jobs coming back, as I said. That's my general theme. Jobs are coming back. The question is, good jobs. There are areas of good jobs. If you look at other industrialized nations, you see that most other industrialized nations have an entire stratum of worker, technical worker, technicians in the factory, laboratory technicians, sales technicians, a stratum of technical worker which we simply do not have in this country. We tend to have our college-educated workers doing the managerial, professional, and highly technical work, and then we have everybody else doing work that is often very low-paying. What we have to do in this country is develop that stratum of technical work. And I could talk in detail about the kind of work that I have seen beginning to be done, but you have to be trained for it. For example, in the 1980s, American companies bought huge amounts of information technology. There is now a crying need for people to integrate that technology, integrate different kinds of information systems. You don't need a college degree to do it. To take another example, demanding slightly less high-tech skills, but nevertheless demanding some skill, home health care. It is a growing area. There will be many people needed. In fact, estimates right now show that over the next few years, particularly if the Clinton health plan is approved, 750,000 new home health care workers will be needed. It's far more efficient to provide many medical services at home. And I could go on. Again, the issue is not so much will there be jobs, there are jobs. The issue is how we train people, how we make sure that there are good jobs out there and jobs that are relatively more secure than the jobs we now have.
Because big labor was a major supporter of the Clinton campaign, how can the administration deal effectively with labor's opposition to NAFTA?
Well, I spent 2 days last week out with the AFL-CIO at their annual convention. I lost about 3 inches in height. Labor is concerned about NAFTA, and I understand labor's concern. Labor is concerned because many Americans are anxious. I believe that that anxiety is misplaced. It is real, it is genuine, but I believe that the source of the anxiety is not Mexico. Again, 24 out of 25 studies, not commissioned by the federal government, independent studies, have shown that NAFTA is going to create more jobs than it displaces. 48 of 50 states have increased dramatically their exports to Mexico over the last 5 years, notwithstanding the fact that their tariffs are 2.5 times our tariffs. The issue is not, in my view, a matter of data. It's not a matter of argument. It goes to the very gut of America. It has to do with anxiety. NAFTA is a lightning rod for that anxiety.
Do you anticipate any trade-offs on NAFTA and the striker replacement bill to appease organized labor?
Let me repeat. The question is, do I anticipate any trade-offs on the North American Free Trade Act or striker replacement in order to appease organized labor? Organized labor, to my knowledge, has not approached the administration suggesting anything it wants in return for lowering its opposition to NAFTA.
What is the administration's position on the striker replacement legislation? Are you trying to deliver that for organized labor?
The administration is in support of striker replacement. The president has come out very strongly and publicly in support of legislation that would ban the permanent replacement of striking workers. I have testified on behalf of that legislation. And let me put this in context, if you will. Although since 1938 it has been technically legal for companies to replace striking workers, it was not until the 1980s that companies on a large scale either began doing it or began threatening to do it. The 1980s have been a period of terrible labor management relations in this country. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. You don't have to be reading the newspapers every day to have witnessed that. Look at what has happened. Company after company, Eastern Airlines, Greyhound, Caterpillar, company after company. I am not singling out companies for blame. I am simply stating the facts. We have had very bad labor management relations in this country. Hopefully, we can close the book on that bad period. One of the origins, one of the reasons that labor, American labor, organized labor, I should say, is particularly distrustful is because of the repeated threat to replace striking workers. They feel that that is a shotgun held right at their temple. They feel that that abrogates the entire fundamental notion in the Wagner Act of the right to collective bargaining. And we are supporting legislation that would prohibit the use of that technique.
You're known as an advocate of industrial policy that promotes closer cooperation between the government and industry. In Japan, however, where that policy has brought about great success, public criticism has recently mounted against the government-industry coalition. What lessons would you draw from the Japanese experience?
Let me just say that industrial policy is one of those terms in public discourse, rare though it is, a term to have gone directly from obscurity to meaninglessness without any intervening period of coherence. If you know what industrial policy is, tell me, because I have lost count. I began talking about this issue. Many others began talking about it 15 years ago. It has tended to represent our fondest hopes or direst fears with regard to the government-business relationship, and I think, unfortunately, it has tended to obscure the reality. The reality is that government and business in this country are now and have always been wedded to one another. One out of every $3 that American business spends for research and development comes from the federal government. And if you look at the tariffs and quotas and loans and loan guarantees and industry bailouts and state tax reductions for particular companies and particular industries, what you see is a sum total of public policy that makes foreigners, even the Japanese, look like pikers by comparison. The issue is not so much do we have an industrial policy in terms of government and industry working together. The question is, do we have a government-industry partnership which actually promotes higher real wages, promotes competitiveness? The answer, it seems to me, is not quite. Some of the steps that the Clinton administration has taken in recent weeks, such as reducing export barriers with regard to high technology exports, such as entering into a research consortium with the Big Three to get a modern engine which has 3 times the fuel efficiency. Those kinds of steps do promote better competitiveness and American jobs. That's the kind of industrial policy I'm in favor of.
Estimates of the job loss from health care reform range from 1 million to 3 million. What is your estimate of any job loss to the overall economy?
Laura Tyson, chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, and I and others last week held a news conference in which we talked about our best estimates with regard to job loss. And net job loss, there's no model. There is simply no model. There is no academic, there's no technical model that will give us a clear answer. Our conclusion is that it is a very tiny, tiny amount of either job loss or job gain on net. Insignificant relative to the great winds blowing through the national economy. Now, having said that, let me also hasten to add that if we get costs under control, healthcare costs under control, it will mean that the paper healthcare segment of the economy, and by the paper healthcare segment of the economy, I'm referring to all of the clerical work and red tape and data processing work and insurance monitoring work that is already eating up a tremendous amount of our healthcare dollars. If we get control, the paper healthcare sector of the economy and all the jobs that go with it will be reduced relatively. But it also means that there will be more primary care jobs. There will be more jobs in areas like home health care, which underscores our need for a system for getting people from one job to another job. You look at military downsizing, defense downsizing. You look at international trade, technological changes, health care. Whatever area you are looking at, you see the same underlying issue, and that is helping people move from job to job.
Won't new mandates for health care, et cetera, add to real total employment costs and reduce net new job creation?
The answer there, in my estimation, is no. Remember, the minimum wage at $4.25 an hour is now 30% below, adjusted for inflation, what it was in 1968. Let me repeat. The minimum wage of $4.25 an hour is now 30% below, adjusted for inflation, what it was in 1968. If we added, and again, our estimates with regard to health care costs for minimum wage workers in small businesses, you're adding about 15 cents an hour to that minimum wage. That is not enough to have any negative employment effects. In fact, you could go up to $4.75 an hour, in my judgment, and have no negative employment effects whatsoever, and that is still only partly back to what the minimum wage was in inflation-adjusted terms in 1968. The president has asked me months ago to give a recommendation, by the way, with regard to the minimum wage, and my conclusion after looking at the data is that the minimum wage could be increased to $4.75 an hour without any effect on job loss. The question is how best to allocate that 50-cent increase between real wage increases, health care costs, or any other benefit for employees.
What is your responsibility for economic conversion from military to civilian jobs, and what are your ideas in that area?
With regard to economic conversion, the Labor Department, many of our jobs programs, jobs retraining programs, have been actively utilized. We have SWAT teams, if you pardon the expression, going into military bases which are about to be closed and utilizing a set of techniques which I think are very relevant for dealing with the problems of normal job loss due to factory closings. That is, the SWAT teams go in. They go in at a very early time, as soon as we know that the base is going to be closed. The earlier you get to workers who are about to lose their jobs or who have lost their jobs, the easier it is to get them to a new job before demoralization sets in, while they still have some momentum. One of the great enemies of getting a new job is the sense of worthlessness and demoralization that sets in on people who don't have a job, among people who don't have jobs. So you've got to get in there early. These SWAT teams are getting in there very early, providing job counseling, even job counseling of the simplest sort, how to prepare a resume. Many people don't even know how to prepare a resume, how to search for the next job. Good, up-to-date job information. And, where appropriate, retraining based upon our knowledge of where there are skills shortages. And those efforts, by the way, with regard to military base closings have, and this is based on a very early, but I think a very suggestive set of evaluations, have had a very positive effect. It's a good model to follow.
What can you tell us about what other major military projects will be funded beyond the third Seawolf submarine as part of the administration's industrial policy to protect jobs?
The question here is, what can you tell us about other major military projects that will be funded? You see what is encapsulated in that question? What's encapsulated in the question is the fear, I believe, that if we reduce military projects, we're going to lose jobs. They don't have to be military projects in order to be job creators. And again, let me stress the major theme that I've tried to develop here, and that is that the sheer number of jobs, although still a problem, although we still have to work on it, although it's a tremendous problem in California and in the central cities, it is, over the longer term, being corrected. The trend is positive. The real jobs problems we have in this country, the hardest nuts to crack, are the quality of jobs problem, the fact that most Americans are on a downward escalator, and secondly, the insecurity, the longer and longer duration of unemployment, helping people get from job to job. I don't believe, personally, and I am speaking only for myself on this, that we ought to be investing a lot of money in new military projects as a job-creating device.
You have launched a task force to review the unemployment survey. To what extent will this show that we have understated the jobless problem?
Beginning with the January numbers, the Bureau of Labor Statistics will be using a new survey, a survey that is more sensitive to many of the jobs issues that I have talked about, looking at part-time workers, looking at the extent to which there are workers who are too discouraged even to look for work. It's not so much a matter that we have understated the jobless problem. It's a matter that we have not had a survey instrument that is as sensitive with regard to that jobless problem as we need in order to better educate policymakers and the public about the nature of jobs. That should begin with regard to the January tallies, and we will hopefully have a period of time, at least 1 month, where the old measurements, the old methodology, is utilized simultaneously with the new methodology, and so the public can understand and compare the results.
Can America ever rebuild her steel and automobile industries to their former size and return those jobs to the workers?
There's a success story going on with regard to the American automobile industry. I don't know how many of you have been following it, but not only do you have tremendous productivity improvements in both steel and autos, but American automobile sales are up. The American automobile industry is doing a fabulous job with regard to quality and productivity. American automobile jobs are actually stopping their hemorrhaging, which is good news. Recently, my wife and I had to buy a new car. And we, particularly given my present position, but even out of patriotism, we wanted to buy an American car. We went to the showroom of one of the big three, and I picked out a car that met my family's needs. And I remember quite pointedly asking the sales agent, I asked the sales representative, that car, we like that car very much, please tell me, I want to know, you must tell me the truth. Was that car assembled here in the United States by American blue-collar workers, or was it assembled elsewhere, like Japan? And he looked at me for a long moment, trying to decide, was I one of those, or was I one of those? And finally, he looked up with a smile and said, which would you prefer? Well, let me make no mistake about it. I prefer American-built cars these days. They are good. We did buy the car. It was American-built. It was built in the Jefferson Avenue plant of Chrysler, which it was a plant, by the way. I don't know how many of you recall this. People said, Chrysler, don't buy it. Don't build it there. Don't refurbish that plant. That's in a very low-income area. It's in a bad area of town. You're never going to be able to get high productivity out of that. Chrysler did it, and I am the proud owner of a Jeep Cherokee at this moment. But let me say more specifically with regard to manufacturing. Manufacturing productivity is increasing. Manufacturing employment in this country continues to decline. Partly, the two go hand in hand. Only 2% of Americans are farmers anymore, but farm productivity is extraordinary in this country. Many people who were on the farm first went into manufacturing. Many people who were in manufacturing have now gone into business services. Many business services, which used to be counted as part of manufacturing, and I'm talking about design engineering, manufacturing engineering, sales, marketing, legal services, financial services, all sorts of other business services, they are now done outside the company, and they now show up on the service part of the national income account. So that manufacturing employment, although factory employment is decreasing, and that's going to happen regardless whether we like it or not, because the fact of the matter is that computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacturing, and robots are making redundant a lot of factory work. Nonetheless, the manufacturing sector, writ broadly, is not decreasing if you include all those business services, and many of those business services are among the highest paid jobs in America.
Before asking the final question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for speaking here today.
Thank you.
And a National Press Club mug.
Oh, I came for this. Thank you. Thank you, Clayton.
You're welcome. Final question is, what do or did you and Robert Bork have in common?
A beard. Thank you.